Name, Jason Horsley. Profession, Limitless. This is The Limitless, the podcast in between. You are now listening. You can walk an island way and you work all the dough and dust. Your eyes were staring at me while playing your guitar.
I came walking a long way just for another chap. Then I saw her in the crowd and I looked her in the eyes.
Hello.
Hi, Jason.
Hi.
How are you doing today?
I don't know. I have to be honest.
Yeah, of course.
How are you doing?
I'm excited to talk to you. I mean, I've spent the last week or so looking through a lot of your material and listening to a lot, which may be not super healthy to sort of go through it all like that, but I've done a lot worse things before.
Right. Not super healthy. Yeah, well, I was saying to somebody recently, I think it might have been that Freemason, that I probably should have a trigger warning on every page of my output at this point.
Oh, well,
anyway.
I've looked at some dark stuff before, so I don't find it... It's not shaking me up that much. It's just thought-provoking. What you put out there is very thought-provoking. And for me, it really seems like it's sort of at the... Well, I mean, there seems like you're one of a couple writers or people who are really addressing the sort of convergence of a lot of topics that are hard to get a firm grip on. And I guess I'm interested how you see yourself compared to some of those other writers.
Yeah, probably not at all. I mean, I try not to, but...
Well, just looking through your stuff, I feel like it's sort of addressing these questions of why we're interested in this. Because the past few years of my life, I mean, you know, when I was younger, I'd looked at some maybe conspiratorial material or things like that, or philosophy, but so the past three years, I really, really seem to be drawn towards this vortex of all this stuff about whether it's just high strangeness or even some of these people like Wilhelm Reich and things like that. It just seems to really address a lot of what's going on these days. And I guess with some of these people, not to dwell on them too much, but somebody like Dream's End, it's not because I'd want to talk to you about any of the details or information he was putting out there, just more what you think of like the significance of this person who touched on all these subjects that are really fascinating and seem to have kind of been sucked into this vortex where people were throwing him off course and then he stopped putting out material out there. I mean, I've read Dream's End materials from almost a decade ago. I've read it on the web archive because I was just curious about what he was talking about, because it seems like the material is definitely related to Whitley Strieber or stuff you're talking about.
It is, yeah. And I mean, in this case, I am interested in this. Like, if you'd brought up somebody like Chris Knowles or Gordon White, as I think you did in an email, I'm not really interested in what they're doing and I wouldn't have anything to say about it. But with Dream's End, I think there's a qualitative difference there. And I'm wondering right now whether the fact that if he was persecuted and harassed and all the rest of it, and he was, I mean, I didn't witness it, but my wife did, and she's testified to it, and it's still out there on Rigorous Intuition, I think. I imagine the threads are still up there. He was kind of hounded, and I mean, I can't say it's a cause and effect thing, but anyway, after that whole thing blew up and it snowballed as it did, he backed away from the whole thing and he hasn't gone back to it since. And as you say, that his material is only really available in the web archives, cache records. It's not, otherwise it's not, you know, I had to cobble together his Whitley Strieber piece and I turned it into a PDF. I think it's available at Autoculture now, but it may not be actually linked anywhere. But anyway, I did that for myself and for others because of this, because it's been buried. And so it's occurring to me now that it may not have so much to do with anything that he was uncovering informationally, but the way that he was approaching it,
because he was doing this sort of insistent detective work or something like that.
No, because he was doing it in a way that was that wasn't just intellectual. I'm not saying this is true, but it may be the case that he was doing it in a way that was more grounded, more embodied, that it was more he was personally involved, not just intellectually, you know, enjoying making these connections like some of these other researchers out there who've built a pretty good career out of it, and they may even be making a living doing it. I mean, certainly, you know, some of the names we could mention, they are, but even some of those who are mostly just blogging but have been doing the same thing consistently for years, and so they've been building a following. I think that part of that relates to the way in which they're approaching it, kind of like more like a job than a necessity or a personal journey, you know, an individuatory journey, as I see what I'm doing and why I keep changing approaches, taking down websites, recreating, renaming myself, and why that has happened over and over again is because I keep undoing the edifices that I'm investigating, and by undoing them, I end up undoing a big part of my own persona. And so with Dream's End, I don't know if that happened, but I do know that from what I've gathered, he got severely burned and he just doesn't want to go there anymore.
Yeah, well, it's really interesting though, because like you said, he's this person who he was dealing with these, he's going after these dangerous topics, he was dealing with concrete facts, but then the fact that somebody like that has sort of blazed that trail, then it's like somebody who wants to do a more intellectualized take on it has that material there. And yeah, that's sort of fascinating too, because I mean, I wouldn't want to put myself in the shoes of somebody taking those risks. I mean, it's a bit of a quixotic endeavor for sure.
Which risks, though?
Risks of going after possibly very sensitive things. Like, I mean, with Dream's End, it seemed like he was talking about people who were still in this establishment that was working on this project to sort of change consciousness in a very... I mean, it's sort of like I was listening to some of your older podcasts and you seem to be talking about this, you know, thing. I mean, it seems like you've moved on from that since, but...
Oh, well, I don't know, actually. I mean, that's why I was asking which risk, because... And I myself, I'm not sure how much of a risk it is to actually expose the designs of the Illumineers, or at least be seen to be attempting to do so.
Well, because that plays into what they're doing anyways.
For all I know, I'm just uncovering a trail of false clues. For all I know, I forgot what I was going to say, but we were onto something there. I felt it was something. Well, with Dream's End, anyway, a big part of it, from what I know from my wife, and as I think I told you in an email, it was through his website that I actually met my wife. So he was kind of like an unofficial. Cupid, you know.
My goodness, it's incredible.
It is incredible. I mean, and so it changes the whole context for me.
There's a lot of crazy, or there's a lot of material out there you can look at, but it takes somebody special, I think, to put something out there that just really rearranges your whole point of view on these things.
So, and you mean that would be something that could be more of a genuine threat to those narratives that are being implemented?
Well, I think it could be a threat, or it could be a part of how the narratives are implemented.
Yeah, well, that's why I wasn't sure who you're referring to here.
Well, Jeff Wells. I was thinking of Jeff Wells, but I guess people like you can find that with. I mean, just reading your stuff totally changes my world around, but it seems like you're talking about some of these oppositions where people are saying, you know, defining themselves by the negative, either... You know, you're either with us or against us, these sort of cool narratives about race and all this stuff like that are quite disturbing. But, I mean, it also seems like it's, maybe you talked about this a bit, but it also seems like it's kind of applicable to the stuff you're writing about in Crucial Fictions, of this whole subterranean world that was sort of being revealed to us about, you know, this, you know, intentional infliction of trauma, child abuse. I mean, some of this coming out in places like the UK, and now it seems to have been put back to bed, that it's almost overload for people to find out about this stuff. I mean, lots of people wanted it to come out, but at the same time, it just seems to have dissipated because it's so hard to deal with. And I'm wondering how that relates to this sort of Girardian stuff you're talking about, in your opinion.
Well, it definitely relates to the liminality, because of when institutions start to be undermined, then that creates a liminal state socially. But before I carry on, I'm just curious what you're basing that judgment that it's kind of dissipated in the UK on, because it seems like it's still being reported constantly, you know?
Okay, yeah, well, I'm not trying to come to any conclusion there. I just mean it's like what's sort of been revealed over the past decade in the whole Western world about that stuff is so shocking, and it's so, I mean, we have to reframe so much just to deal with it. So much prehistory.
Yeah, well, there's another factor too, which is just, I was just talking about with my wife, and that is if it's representing something real, it's a reality, which I think it is, then let's just say in the UK for now, because that's where it really is, it's mainstream coverage in the UK pretty much daily or weekly. If it's accurate, we're talking about, I mean, Lloyd DeMouse's figures are shocking. I mean, there's something like between 25 and 50% of people have been abused as children. I mean, it seems unthinkable that it could possibly be accurate. But then if you do start thinking about it, well, how would we know, right? Because the memories get suppressed. The perpetrators certainly don't talk about it. Many of the victims don't want to talk about it. How the hell do we actually even know? And so then, and I don't know what DeMouse is basing his calculations on, but anyway, there are others who are coming up with, or have come up with, similarly surprisingly high figures. And then so in the UK, yeah, it's finding more and more perpetrators. And I mean, I just read something in this Blasphemous Rumours about how paedophiles, here it is, child sex offenders always repeat their crime. A recent study of 571, this was recent in 1991, but anyway, 571 child molesters in America showed that each had abused an average of 380 children. So if you then add to that the fact that the children who are abused sexually tend to, I mean, the odds of them growing up and having the kind of psychic configuration where they can't help themselves but reenact the abuse and become abusers themselves, it's a large percentage. Those figures suggest that these numbers would be growing beyond exponentially. They would just be going off the chart. So I'm not saying this is necessarily true, but to the extent that it is true, all this coverage in the UK, how many people are being triggered by this because they themselves, you know, had that those experiences as children, and many don't even remember it, but and some do, but all of them who it happened to have the memories in the body, that's getting stirred up. I mean, it really is, if you think about that, it's not just the mental, the you know, the rational thing of, oh my god, this is really shocking, it's in the body, and the anxiety that would generate, and the need to suppress it, and all of the different recourses that people would be taking to try and keep that very trauma from coming up. Yeah, it's gonna polarize, and it's gonna destabilize in a massive way, I think.
Yeah. It's heavy stuff to talk about, even, but I think, I mean, it's obvious that what you're talking about, I mean, this ripple or this wave of reaction to, you know, this attempt to talk about or deal with it is itself something that can be hijacked or exploited.
Yeah.
Which is obviously playing into some of this, what this kind of like mimesis-like stuff too.
Well, I have reluctance to talk about it, and when I do talk about it, and not just, I mean, obviously it's disturbing to me, because of my own personal history, but also because I don't want to play into that mimesis that is covertly shaping and directing the narrative in such a way that it doesn't bring about the catharsis or the healing that is you know, optimal, that we, that I hope for as an individual, and I think many individuals are also ready for that, for a real catharsis healing. I don't think collectively as a society that's ever going to happen. I don't think societies allow for that by their very nature. Talking about child abuse or talking about paedophiles, using the terminology that's actually been handed down to us, I think is already, you're already stepping into the trap to some extent, I think.
Well, even the idea of this, like, complete reconciliation or something, but it's a bit of some sort of unattainable goal, but definitely, and it's sort of like, it's the idea of some complete reconciliation or cathartic healing, is that not a bit like this mimetic thing of where that's that critical point, tipping point into all these different parties have kind of assumed the same face, so they need to differentiate themselves?
I'm not sure what you mean.
Sorry, I'm not being very particular with that one.
I mean, do you want more time with that, or
maybe just say, like, I mean, this image of it's in a lot of religious, some sort of messianic Christian type thing of, you know, everything will be set to right. I mean,
oh yeah, that idea. Itself,
even as this forestalled image, it's this picture of everything that's differentiated, and it's not, and it's all like, in reality, it's all, it's never here nor there. It's very liminal in reality, but it's this image of it becoming perfectly reconciled and...
Right. No, well, that's what I said, as a society, it's not going to happen.
Of course, yeah.
But if individually, which is all that you or I or anyone has to really think about or face, I mean, we're in, an individual's in the context of a collective, of course, so, but in terms of catharsis, we can only really know about our own, and we can only bring about our own. Maybe we can't even do the latter. Maybe that is too much of, as what you're saying, is this idea that's already been, we've been indoctrinated with, of some resolution, maybe. But I have a feeling that, as far as with Gerard and this subject, that it has to do with the Greek theatre, because Gerard talked about Greek theatre and talked about catharsis, that how the Greeks were very careful not to show the violence on the stage because of mimetic violence. If the audiences were built up into a frenzy by the tension of the drama, and then they actually saw the violent resolution, they might go and imitate that, which is what's happening, I guess, in Hollywood. Although the whole idea that movies and TV influence people to act violently is, obviously, it's kind of been rejected by the neoliberal mindset, but I think prematurely, I don't think it was ever really understood or investigated in a sincere way. But anyway, in Gerard's thing, that would be a problem, and that the Greek theatre was, yes, don't show the violence because people imitate it, and don't show it because if they don't have the violent resolution enacted for them, which doesn't work anyway, they will go away. Funny enough, Polanski said this about why he gave a bad ending to Chinatown. They will go away with that tension, and they won't be able to resolve it until they go into it. They'll have to find a resolution within themselves. So I think that's the potential here, is that there's this collective social liminality, all the revelations around the deviant behaviors of the plutocracy and all that stuff. There's nothing that can be done at a social level, and if we try, it'll just make it worse, I think. But we can talk about it, and we can actually allow ourselves to experience the tension of that narrative, that collective drama that we're in, not to diminish it as if it was fiction, but and feel it really allows us to experience it. And then there'll have to be something inner has to come to our rescue, like in the myths.
Well, I think it's very clever in your stuff how you, like I think you said a couple of minutes ago, you want to avoid playing into this this sort of violent backlash about coming from people that can't cope with what's sort of being revealed. And I think it's funny, because I haven't read all of Greek drama or anything, but I just know, like, Aeschylus or Aristia, if you look at that backwards, I guess it's sort of showing, you know, the founding of social order and going backwards into this very, very dark stuff. And I guess if he really wasn't showing the violence, like you say, but he was talking about it, I guess that's a really good analogy there. But,
I mean, I don't know enough myself, because we can lay all kinds of blame at the door of the Greeks. You know, Plato is definitely, can be seen as the original social engineer and all the rest, so I'm sure that there are flaws in my using this model. But again, I think it has some psychological truth in it anyway, even if it wasn't what the Greeks were doing, the way that Girard talked about catharsis and narratives and individual inner resolution. To me, that feels like that's true, because that's what I've been experiencing in my life, like finding out more and more about the external machinations of the kakistocracy, is this phrase I heard on the Corbett Report, whatever we're going to call them, but anyway, I don't even want to name the fuckers, but just finding out about that stuff, and then finding out more and more how close to home it was in my own family background, has coincided with a willingness and an ability to tune into my own trauma and actually become more conscious of it. And so it does seem like it's a mirror, using the world as a mirror. It's like a surgical mirror. I've used this analogy before. We have to do surgery on ourselves to remove the implant, and like, you know, if Neo had to do it all alone, it's unthinkable really, but you begin with that. The world's a mirror, and you hold the world as a mirror, and you bring the blade down, and you start the surgery on yourself. And it's very, very dark. And I think it's like in the myths, it's a willingness to actually try something that you know is impossible, that allows for the thing that can bring about the impossible resolution, which is where, you know, the Christian myth is not 100% bogus to me. Like, divine intervention, I think, is a metaphor that is true. Like, we're not capable of doing it on our own.
Yeah.
Whatever it is.
I was just wondering if I could shift into, like, you had all this really interesting writing about UFOs. You have this Exploding the UFO, I think it's called.
Yeah, I think so. The bottle, Exploding the UFO bottle.
Yeah, and I know there's a lot of things going on in that, but one thing that struck me, you think it's fair to say some of what you're doing there is taking the kind of views about someone like, views of someone like Jacques Vallée about a control system, you're kind of zooming that in on the individual and saying, well, this is actually what's going on inside each of us.
Yeah, that's true.
Another thing that really struck me when I read that is that you're talking about the UFO as this very much this sort of marker of indeterminacy and ambiguity. And I was just thinking, like, do you think it's fair to say that UFOs, being that they also kind of put a seal on that stuff, they keep it safely, or at least the image of UFOs sort of seal that stuff up, bottle that stuff up, they keep it all sort of hermetically sealed, I guess, so that our supposedly objective reality will have some coherence. It needs that sort of bow on top. Is that sort of what you're saying in that kind of piece, or?
Have you, just quickly, have you got your Facebook page open over there?
I'm really sorry, yeah.
Yeah, because basically we're being reminded of Facebook every 5 seconds. So.
Oh, I'm very sorry.
You can just close that. It'd be nice. Seal off the ambiguity. So is that like... I'm sure there's a good metaphor here, but I always have trouble groping into the unconscious for the right metaphor, but it seems as though it has to do, what you're saying has to do with the people. It's like a Christian who goes to church every Sunday, that kind of thing, and they spend the rest of the week they do what the fuck they want. So if we explore the UFO, then we're kind of we're paying tithes to the ambiguity of existence and acknowledging it while trying to solve it, of course, as opposed to me, the UFO, and this is what Prisoner Infinity is as a finished work now, I see. It's not using psychology to understand the UFO. It's using the UFO to understand psychology and the psyche.
Okay.
So it's a window. The UFO, or anything, but the UFO really is just demands, or it did. I mean, it's gone now. I feel like it's almost dead, the whole thing now. But anyway, it demands, that you don't want, you can't contain the ambiguity of the UFO. It's a virus. Once you've seen that that's what the UFO is, you can't unsee it, and you can't, unless you're going to put it in the bottle, like you say, then you can't stop it from spreading to everything else.
Well, yeah, I definitely agree with what you just said. It's been my experience. I've had experiences of seeing UFOs with other witnesses very close myself.
Yeah.
It was much more like what you just said. But then there's a flip side to that. Of any representation or narrative I try to make about that, it's going to be a bit like that bottle, I think. I mean, maybe not in a bad way, but...
Well, if we want to talk about it, I mean... but it's you can talk about, and again, this is Prisoner Infinity, was about this. You can talk about how you're doing that by talking about it. See what I mean?
I'm aware of it or something.
Well, but that's the interesting part of it, isn't that you saw a UFO and it was ambiguous or it was liminal. It's that, it's also that by talking about it, you are actually stripping it of that, and therefore this is what we do with everything, because we talk about everything, we think about everything.
Yeah.
So it's pretty tidy, isn't it? It's symmetrical. Is that by trying to explain the inexplicable, we show how we shut ourselves off from the inexplicable. So we're actually learning to understand that. Why do we quarantine ourselves from mystery?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't feel that... I think we all do quarantine ourselves from mystery, and sometimes we do that even when we've tried to do the opposite of it, which I think is what a lot of your stuff is about.
Yeah, well, it's the Guardian. The Guardian will... And this is why enlightenment is the biggest trap of all, I think. Not the experience. If it happened, maybe that would be it. But, I mean, the concept of enlightenment would be the biggest trap of all, because, as I was doing that on the last podcast, once you name the thing... Once you even try to think about the thing, then you're giving it to the Guardian, the part of you that is preventing it from happening. you know, is keeping us quarantined.
Well,
was that coherent?
Well, it doesn't matter. Like, it definitely is a good comment on this, because I mean, we're never going to get to the bottom of this stuff.
No, it doesn't have a bottom.
Yeah.
That's the bottom, right?
Okay.
Can you get to the point where you see it doesn't have a bottom, then you've got to the bottom. I mean, as good as, because that's, I mean, to bring it back to enlightenment, the person that I know who I do trust, who does use that word, even though that's one thing I don't really understand why he would. But anyway, his definition of what happened to him was that his questing ended, that he was no longer seeking from that moment on. And fair enough, if that's true and that's what happened to him, that would seem to be a very real goal to reach.
Yeah.
The end of all our seeking.
But I think what you're putting out there recently with these liminalist materials, it's maybe it's not as good of a goal as that, but it's actually more interesting than that, because you're both seeking and you're pushing people away from forms of seeking that are not really performing what they set out to do.
I don't necessarily want to be more interesting, but I understand, I appreciate what you're saying, and I've thought the same, like what I do is more interesting than any spiritual teacher out there, because they're just saying stuff we've already heard before, right? But on the other hand, ideas that are interesting is mind stuff anyway, so I guess what I hope is happening with the stuff that I'm doing is that I'm ending my own questing in a public way, and so people can see it ending. I don't know. I mean, I honestly don't know. Will I still do podcasts if I reach that state where I feel that my questing is over? I guess we'll find out.
Was cold and hungry where I was young, had to burn the coal Dad coughed up from his lung. We kept the Bible by the outhouse holes, we tore the pages out to cleanse our souls. I came home blinded from the Spanish War, I told my gal I couldn't see her no more. Now I live in a bottle, my door is ajar. I sweep up sawdust and sleep in the bar. Now I'm glad this world is not our home, though I won't be headed up to heaven's dome. When the signs appear and the trumpet calls, let me make my pallet where the comet falls. It's a T for shovel and T for pick. Never learned to read, I went to work too quick. It's a O for Reno and a D for Bend. I'm wandering round just waiting for the end. I had a shotgun wedding, she's long and black. She sleeps beside me in our shotgun shack. Once a wee were a kissing and she chipped my tooth. I shot my mouth off and hit the roof. Now I'm glad this world is not our home, though I won't be headed up to heaven's dome. When the signs appear and the trumpet calls, let me make my pallet where the comet falls.
I, I think there's a line that gets crossed at a certain point between, yes, I am, or we are somehow collaborating with the perceptual experience. We are part and parcel of the universe, and kind of sinking into that and settling into that awareness and just allowing it to contextualize everything. There's a line that gets crossed from that to, I'm creating my own reality, and I'm one of the, you know, I can be, you know, Illuminati are us, and we too can shape the world. We can be the change that we're hoping for. That, to me, that's the line that makes the difference between being on the social engineered team and not being on it. Like being part of the problem and not being part of the solution, because if you want to be part of the solution, then you become part of the problem, but just not being part. I mean, the road least traveled, or the eye of the needle, is not to participate, to engage, but not to participate, if that makes sense. I mean, I haven't put this in words before, but it's like engaging with reality is not the same as being involved in society. See what I mean? So society is a part of the whole thing, so it's as interesting and as rich in information as nature and the universe and everything else, but it's not separate from it. And we wouldn't, most of us wouldn't, well, actually it's not true, transhumans are busy trying to change everything, but as I say, most of us anyway don't want to sort of go up to every tree we say and we see and try and re-engineer it in a way that would be better. But we do look at society that way, that how can we improve it? So that, to me, that's the kind of assumption that goes so deep. Because we created society, we need to improve society. I don't know if this is answering your question or not.
No, it is.
Is it? Yeah. So, because I don't think that we created society. I don't think the social engineers created it. It's a bit weird, because I'm busy exposing, and like there is a part of me that's sort of that feels like that. Oh, look at these bastards! Look what they're doing. Definitely, I do have that emotional reaction, because it's so cynical and it's so controlled and it's so kind of overt, the manipulations. But I think, again, they're just symptoms of something else. So it's like when you talk about astrology, this idea that people have is that the planets are affecting us and shaping our destiny. But no, that's not true. That's not an accurate description of astrology anyway. The planets are like hands on a clock. They're not creating time. They're being moved by the same forces that are moving us. So if we look at the planets, we can get a sense of what the forces are doing, because they do it to the planets before they get to us, kind of thing, or the planets are bigger than us. So it's the same with the social engineers. It's not that we can look at what they're doing and figure out what they're doing. It's that we can look at what they're doing and figuring out what's being done through them. And that thing that's doing all of that is coming from, well, that's the big mystery, isn't it? You know, it's,
yeah. Well, you're saying, I mean, it sounds a lot like a lot of these sort of elaborate, like hermetic kind of ideas where, you know, this self-reflexive property and everything is gradually like becoming more aware of itself. And that's just reflecting back on the whole thing that got it started going in the first place. But I mean, I think those kinds of ideas, they're a lot, that's not the sort of stuff you're referring to when you're talking about people like Crowley and stuff as this much more unwholesome version of, as it
right, does. But that has to do with, that's just like choosing a good environment to plant your plants in. It's like that. It's like, who do you associate with? What ideas do you surround yourself by? What things do you put in your body? It's more to do with that. It's not about pointing the finger and saying they did that. It's that they're part of there's an energy that is specific to what those people are doing that is adverse to my own well-being.
Well, I agree. I mean, I get a bad vibe from people like Crowley or Jeep and stuff like that. But
Yeah.
So, I mean, I haven't read this whole Prisoner Infinity, but when you say it's using the UFO to comment on psychology, is that a bit like what you're saying about exteriorization, that even when we try to adopt this practice of psychology or something, it's sort of exteriorizing something? And
yeah, which is a bit weirdly symmetrical, because what Prisoner Infinity is about, or what it kind of gets to in the end, is that we have exteriorized the psyche, as in we've dissociated, and the psyche hasn't been able to land in the body, so we didn't really exteriorize it because it never got to be interior. But anyway, the psyche is on the outside of the body where it doesn't belong, and hence it's coming to us as a UFO and other things, of course, but it's trying to get back in, and so to reenact the trauma that prevented it from landing in the first place. So the UFO and alien abductions, which is a binary thing, they're not synonymous, but anyway, they all seem to be weird sort of external expressions of the psyche as it looks from the scene from the inside out. So then the exteriorization, it's we do it with everything. So psychology is also, I mean, that's become true of psychology as a science also, because now it's not really about exploration of the inner, it's more about lifestyle, taking the right drugs, the medication. It seems like it's psychology has become more mechanistic, so it seems to have more to do with addressing the body than the psyche, because like the psyche has almost been removed from psychology, I think. So I think that's, I'm a bit going a bit off track here, but I think that the exteriorization thing goes hand in hand with the otherizing, you know, the disowning. So when you disown the psyche, because it's trauma, that's where the trauma is, then you're just a body, but the body can't live either. Can't live without the psyche, it just becomes a shell, so that's not comfortable either. So then we have to disown the body too, and that's transhumanism. Transhumanism is the goal to exist without a body or a psyche. Which, fuck, I mean, all that leaves is code, I guess, you know, like an internal dialogue.
Run my heart, run my soul. Leave no stain except my pain. Carry out your dirty crimes. Don't be afraid, I will not fight. God's found. God's found. God's found. God's found. Question no answers, lies that confessions, funeral. Smiles, betrayal faces, Sherlock Holmes's dissection vein. Find no proofs, so single clues, God's found.
I just wanted to do a segue, because I thought, now that you have this forum and you have these podcasts and everything, I mean, you're a person who's, you wanted to kind of pick apart these audience cults and stuff, but do you ever feel like you're possibly creating an audience cult or something?
It's possible, yeah. I mean, if I I mean, it's inevitable, I should say, because there's no limit. You know, there's three people can still is still an audience, and therefore is still potentially a cult. Every audience cult or any kind of cult begins with one or two people. Well, one person, obviously, but two or three before it's actually the cult. Before there's any belief and so forth. So, or hope, diffuse hope. So yeah, I don't see any way to avoid that. And you know, it's, I guess it's just something I'm going to have to face and go through, because I have the same problem with this enlightenment teacher. I'm feeling like not naming him because, well, I think it's just better anyway. But he, you know, he has a website and all the rest of it, and he teaches enlightenment, and he has followers, and or not followers, but participants. And my feeling is that that is it just seems like a really bad thing to end up doing. But if he wasn't doing that, I would never have found him. And I had a really, really helpful and valuable experience participating in what he does. So I know it's good. And so, and what's built up around it has made it, has also made it possible for people like me to have that experience. So the same, you and I are having this conversation, which maybe is going to be meaningful or useful to both of us in some way. At least it's an enjoyable way to pass a Sunday afternoon. And that wouldn't happen if I hadn't created this little ministry.
Of course.
So then it seems to me that the audience cult is necessary as a means to the end, and but paradoxically, or contrary to the usual sequence of structure, whatever, that we think of in capitalism, the end is much smaller than the means. Like, if I can create an audience call and it's big enough, then I will be able to reduce it to those individuals that are really worth connecting to, that there is something actually of value there, and they're never going to be coming to me for hope anyway.
Yeah, well, I wasn't trying to say it's like a bad thing. I mean,
well, I know, but to me it is.
Well, one other thing that's funny about it, though, is that almost like that, I haven't read the source text on audience cults that you cited, but the audience cults, like, idea, I mean, I feel like that's sort of become, like, everything is sort of turning into an audience cult, because you have young people that are into these fandoms and stuff, which themselves are sort of taking on these cult-like characters, or these very, you know, mimetic and, you know, kind of fractured character, because you have all these subgroups that are, like, becoming echo chambers, bubbling themselves off, not speaking to each other, and that's happening at the same time as there is a monoculture where everyone's being, participating into something that is very homogenous. And I I know you've been out there doing your thing probably for many years now, but just seeing this liminalist stuff you've been doing, I can't help but think, you know, more stuff is going to be coming down the pipe just in our culture that's like what you're doing. I mean, because you're bringing it together. I mean, I'm sure there's younger people doing all kinds of stuff, but you're bringing together a lot of stuff that's very relevant to a lot of things that are going on right now. And also, just now that I listened to some of your older podcasts and things, like these Stormy Weather ones, it's just really funny how it seems like the zeitgeist has changed, how just the feeling in the air has changed. Because, you know, a couple of years ago, which is when I started looking at websites like Rigorous Intuition Forum and stuff, there was a lot more of a sense of wonder and enchantment, and all this stuff was this curiosity. And now it's becoming very, it's becoming very depressingly real. Like, you know, because just like you've been talking in your forum, I mean, there's just these, yeah, everyone knows about this stuff now. That's what I'm getting at. Everyone knows about this stuff. Everyone's getting up in arms about this stuff. Everyone.
Which stuff particularly?
Well, all the stuff that you talked about is like alternate perceptions community. I mean,
you mean the sort of movement towards kind of extremist activism and stuff?
Yeah, I mean, like, I think I read a quote someone was saying where it's now, they're now making laws against conspiracy sort of beliefs, but it's also being encouraged at the same time. And that's just going to radicalize the expressions of it even further.
Yeah.
Or else you see things out there that, I mean, certainly like on YouTube, you see these flat earth videos that look like this disinformation campaign meant to really mess with very vulnerable people. And it's just so disorienting. Like, you can imagine the kind of person that would be sucked in by that. Or
yeah, and this guy Miles Mathis too. Because
yes, maybe, I got that vibe.
I got that vibe. I mean, it might be premature. He may disappear next year. But it seemed like he was, you know, I heard about him one day, and then the next couple of weeks I kept hearing about him. And so it did seem like he was on the rise. And although I haven't gone through his site, the general consensus is that he's basically saying everything's a conspiracy, everything's fake, you know, everyone you thought was dead is alive, and half the people you think are alive are dead and been replaced, and, you know, ad absurdum. So on the one hand, it's obvious to poison the well, that's a very good way, you create a lot of bogus conspiracy narratives, and it gets harder and harder to tell the good from the bad and the real from the unreal. That's obvious that could be a technique for that. But less obvious is what you're touching on, which is, and I'm feeling it more acutely now, is that the sort of feeling of just being on really shaky ground as far as what's real and what's not real, not on a day-to-day level, but in terms of talking about anything.
Where I live in Montreal, very, very far to the left, and very often people will take an approach that if you ask a question about what they're talking about, if you express anything other than enthusiastic agreement with what their opinion is, and it's, you're immediately like shamed and targeted, and, you know, these opinions aren't coming from a collective, they're coming from a couple of people that are directing these groups. And then that goes into all these questions of how does that structure even come into place? It's not, as you know, it's not all conspiracy. It's also just part of how we relate to each other and how we navigate that.
Yeah, it's a psychological mechanism, is what it is, that is being manipulated. And it's being manipulated by us as individuals, because instinctively we know, some of us more than others, you know, what the safest position to take is, where the power is, how to align with the power. But it's also, it seems very clear to me, or, you know, pretty hard to refute anyway, that it's also that psychological mechanism is being researched and understood and exploited by specific, you know, agendas. And so information's being seeded out there so that, to use this the handy narrative again, that if you start to question the narrative around World War II, it's so unsafe to just be in the questioning realm. You're going to get lumped with the neo-Nazis and the white supremacists anyway, so you end up associating with them, and the information leads you to that anyway, because it's spiked ground, I think, so that you, instead of just saying, well, okay, so there was some Russian propaganda here, there was some British propaganda here, what we heard about the Nazis wasn't 100% true, rather than just staying with that, and, well, we don't really know, you end up following this spiked ground to the phony pastry, which is Hitler was actually the avatar of this and that, Vishnu, what's it, and was actually trying to free us from the reign of the empire, and blah 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 blah, the whole Neo-Thulean thing. It's the, you know, the resurrection of Camelot, whatever.
Well, it's just described as a lot like these versions of tantric or like alchemical cults where they've gone wrong because they've seen this kind of, instead of sort of dissolving these paradoxes and stuff that would help them understand themselves, they've sort of become trapped in a concentric paradox where everything that's the opposite of, you know,
right.
Which sort of reminds me of, I think, I'm not sure whether this was older material of yours or not, but where you're talking about somebody who's trying to complete this sort of shamanic dissolution of the self and then return to the self, but they never returned or something like that. And they're just stuck trying to reenact that individuation by killing, becoming serial killers or whatever. And I mean,
right, that's the great American psychopath. Yeah,
when I see some of these great American psychopaths, they're out there in the public world. I mean, it seems like they want to do that in front of an audience, and they want to, I mean, of course, it's old hat now to talk about events that are designed to traumatize the masses and stuff. I mean, we all know that's happening, and I think that's why I'm a fan of your stuff, is you're trying to come up with a response to it that isn't just, you're not trying to just pacify people or work people up into some reactionary fear. You're like, you're really in a liminal space, I guess. So,
it's sanity, isn't it? I mean, if you're in that liminal space where the mimetic violence is rising, and you see that the pressure to take sides is so great. I mean, to me anyway, it becomes more and more paramount not to give in to that pressure,
mm-hmm.
to not take sides. So, in order to, and that, I mean, that's because that's the, I think that is the individuation process, actually. We're like a child that's torn between divorced parents, you know, it that is a double bind, you know, and it can't be loyal to both, and so it can't be loyal to either, and the only thing that's left is to individuate, is to actually find something internally that to be loyal to give oneself to.
Inside you've got his animal eyes of wild fear. Down deep inside, surely in need of a wild growing fire, no place to hide. A wild growing fire, it is a world of fear. It is a world of fear. It is a world of fear. It is a world. Follow a line, would it lead to a crime in which you die? Stop following a line, thinking inside, lose control inside, betray your eyes. Down deep inside, it is a world of fear. It is a world.
You know, when we're talking about this sort of vortex someone like Dream's End disappeared into, then it's like, well, with the really diabolical, really clever, really insanely clever aspects of that, I think I can understand how you'd say, well, this stuff is being generated by a collective unconscious, it's being generated by the unconscious of individuals as well as being a conscious plan. But then in the kind of narratives we've been using to talk to each other, we keep coming back to how, yeah, there are conscious people consciously planning kind of thing, which is inevitable too, but it's just strange because we don't see these behaviors in day-to-day life. We don't see people crafting these kinds of like extremely
level things. Do you have a day job?
Well, I have before quite a bit, yeah,
because I've never had one, so I can't testify, but I was just reading this book called Operators and Things, which Phil Snyder sent me, and she's talking about she became schizophrenic, and it's her testimony, but I think before she starts hallucinating, quote-unquote, she describes her observation of people at work and how there's these individuals she calls hook operators, and they're quite easy to observe if you know the signs, and how they... She describes a specific thing. I don't know how accurate this is, because I say I've never worked in a workspace, but she describes how a hook operator figures out who's a power player in the workplace, and then they look for somebody who's on the up, who's on the rise, and they basically subtly seed doubts in the power person that the person who's on the rise is somehow bad mouthing them, and basically they play those two against each other, so the power person becomes more and more insecure, and basically attacks and scapegoats the the person who's on the up who's trying to socially climb, until it, you know, escalates, and basically that the person who's on the climb gets kicked out of the company, and then the operator, the hook operator, of course, has cleared the playing field a little bit, and also, but also he's discovered more about the weaknesses of that person in power, and so this kind of thing, I think, goes on all the time.
Yeah, I've seen that in like university. I haven't even gotten that far in university. I started it, I'm in my late 20s, and it seemed like academics act that way with each other. I think, I guess I can see how it scales up to some extent. It's just, it's odd how so much of this material always circles back around the same very small amount of people. So it's like, once we're talking about things like transhumanism, we're like, how many people, if this really is just going to be for the chosen one few and not for the masses, then it's like, how small is that group going to be? And is that going to impede them ever being able to achieve their goals? Because they're so tiny, this group. I mean,
yeah, well, sure. But then the question needs to remain open as to whether their spoken goals and their professed goals are actually their goals, right? Because, I mean, Bainbridge is all about creating these audience cults and creating a galactic religion, but that doesn't mean that he actually wants to participate in the galactic religion. It doesn't mean that the tenets of it, which have to do with transhumanism and, you know, emigrating into space, you know, as information and all the rest of it, they may not be the goals. They may just be the means to create the religion, and the religion may just be have to do with some sort of earthly plan to keep people enslaved to the false hope of some better future, so they'll keep working away for the capitalist machinery so that the few can keep on living it up the way they want to live it up, right? So
then we're back to just like those basic bodily drives and things, and the extreme disconnection from them that would happen if you've been part of this like crazy stuff.
Although, I mean, I do think the trans, I mean, the for somebody to be a spokesperson and a leader like Strieber is in that field, or Kurzweil is in the transhumanist field, they pretty much have to have the fervor or the fanaticism of a true believer. So I think that that's part of it too. And so with Kurzweil and maybe all of these people, there seems to be the dissociative drive to transcend the flesh. That's in Christianity too, and the saints and the martyrs were doing that kind of stuff too. So, you know, you can pick your suspect, really. It's kind of across the board, that drive to transcend the flesh, bring back to Gnosticism, that's very real. I mean, that can be engineered. Like, if you traumatize somebody enough, but also you do it in an environment or in a context whereby they will dissociate in the right way, they will develop the right skills, the right psychic abilities, and so on, then you can create a spokesperson, a false ceremony master, I think. I mean, it seems, why not?
They put P.T. Barnum on the dollar bill. If you're not a sucker, then you're just a shill. Now I'm out here strung up in my family tree, born to be a seedy effigy. Oh, the old New Mexico I knew was sold, where the Hopi hoped and the tumble storms rolled. I found a haystack and needles, and I'm off to bed. My home is anywhere I hang my head. Now I'm glad this world is not our home, though I won't be headed up to heaven's dome when the signs appear and the trumpet calls. Let me make my pallet where the comet falls.
Anyways, it's been really great talking to you, and you know, I'm really grateful you responded to me and everything, because I don't really have any material out there of my own about any of this stuff. I'm just somebody who follows it a bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was thinking just a couple of days ago, I had an idea to invite people to do a collective Skype and record that and make podcasts out of those sort of meetings as well. I don't know if it's a good idea or not, but it's making you laugh, so that's something.
Sounds like you could do some interesting ones with some of the people you've had on there, for sure.
Well, it wouldn't so much be the people I've had on, although I suppose I could invite them too. I mean, everyone would be invited. So it could just be, I mean, people wouldn't have to speak.
Of course,
it would be like a live thing. So there's enough people, say 5 people, and then people could ask questions and or just contribute something, or, you know, just bring up some topic that they wanted to talk about and just see how that develops. I mean, one of the reasons is there's a limit to how many people I can find on the podcast, because I'm trying to be very discerning. I don't just want to find people who are doing interesting stuff. I want to find people who are doing it, like I said about Dream's End. It's not what you're researching, it's how that you're researching it. And I wouldn't say that I've had 100% success with people on the podcast, but most of them, I'd say, are doing it in what I feel is the right spirit. So there's a finite number, so this would be a way to have an alternate kind of methodology for the podcast. But I'm wary, because even talking to you, I was going to say this right at the beginning, but we landed running, as it were, that talking to, like, being interviewed or talking to somebody who's, I think you even used the word fan, but anyway, even if you didn't, who's got a little bit of that, it's a very safe, comfortable space for me and to be in, at least to begin with, and that's anti-liminal. I what's valuable in the podcast to me is this sort of exploratory thing between two people, and the slight unsafeness and the not knowing, and so and that gets lost if it's just me, but it can also get lost if I'm in too comfortable a position and, you know, people are relating to me as some sort of authority.
It just reminds me of, like, just the way you described it originally made me laugh, because it reminded me of, like, Quaker meetings, which I've never been to, but supposedly I had, like, grandfather or something, just these, like, unstructured discussions and stuff, which, and then I gathered that ended up being, like, the sort of thing that rippled through all this, a lot of this whole milieu, where a lot of weird stuff was happening in the 20th century and stuff like that.
What, the Quaker thing?
Well, not them specifically as a religious group, but, like, more of those sorts of discussions they were having than would have, you know, like, that was then adopted by all these hippies and stuff, quite consciously, and then, And then I'll just have a lot of these things, like, I've always known that, like, Aleister Crowley was grew up in that religious group, the Plymouth Brethren, is that correct?
Actually, I don't know about that.
But, I mean, I read the other day that John Money, the sexologist, also came from that religious group, which then goes back into all this sort of stuff you're writing about with your, like, Fabian,
yeah,
weird stuff, because they were taking, like, these extremely puritanical groups, and then those become the seed for something else, or things like that.
Well, that's interesting. I should look into that. Because, yeah, as you know, if you read The Occult Yorkshire, my grandfather was a Quaker. My uncle still is, I mean, he's still alive.
It's not something I understand very well myself. Like, I understand enough to know that people do massive amounts of research trying to figure out just what happened with all these religious movements. And, I mean, I've never read even, I don't know much about, like, the history of religion at all, even. All I know is that I've tried to understand what the Western esoteric tradition is about, somewhat. And I know that there's this big change that happened with, like, Freemasonry and all that stuff, right? And then I know my grandfather, like, I wasn't raised with any religious background. I know my grandfather was in this esoteric Quaker kind of group where they didn't pass it on to their own children because people were supposed to find that group by itself. And he was also communist, involved in all this stuff that was very close to the kind of things that you were saying and the Fabian thing, or else I've met some Jewish people who said that their families, for instance, had repudiated Judaism as a ethnicity and a religion to sort of convert to communism. And, you know, a couple of generations later, they'd found out, oh, I had these Jewish ancestors and stuff like that, which sounded obviously very different from what I'm talking about with my grandfather, but sort of like somehow tangential in a way. So now I'm a little far from where, but I mean, it sounds like maybe my grandfather, like maybe it wasn't a Freemasonic group, but it was, I mean, even the origins of Quakerism itself go back to all this stuff about Hermetism and stuff.
Yeah.
So it's quite a rabbit hole. And then, like, I mean, my dad and my brother have even gone to Quaker meetings just out of curiosity. I never have. But the thing with the Plymouth Brethren was something else. It was just Aleister Crowley came from that group that was very hardcore Protestant, very extremist group. And then I also noticed that John Money was also, just from his Wikipedia thing, who was a sexologist who, I didn't know if he was directly associated, but somehow tangentially associated to that kind of Fabian type stuff that you were researching. And then when you look at the very, very, very extremely, you know, Wahhabi, Islam, very extreme forms of, like, if you've heard of this, these very new versions of Christianity that are being spread in China or the States that are all about, you know, bringing about the end times and things like that too, and how that all kind of goes back to these networks and how it all kind of, like, you know, flows in and out. That's sort of what I was getting at. So I should go because we talked for so long.
I was thinking I could say something and then we'd be off again, I think. So perhaps to be continued. Anyway, I mean, certainly this area is something that I would quite like to talk about possibly at some point. So I'll just we'll just leave it at that for now, and I'll see what we got this time.
It was really great to talk to you, because I'm just some random dude. I've never put anything I liked about this at all.
You're just a random dude.
Exactly.
Monkey said to man, I want your fireman. Said to monkey, I want your brain. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind. And this was all the monkey said when his world come tumbling. Monkey said to man, I want your fireman. Said to monkey, I want your prayer. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind. And this was all the monkey spilled when his world came tumbling. His mind. Out here comes the monkey, and monkey speaks his mind. Out here comes the monkey, and monkey speaks his mind. And this was all that monkey spoke when his word came tumbling down.
La vie dans la jungle, c'est comme un sympa. Des lèvres l'air de bois, tout pose des problèmes. Les songes sur les arbres préparent.